Okay, so in six short years, the Chinese Communist Party went from a tiny handful of student radicals to a mass party of approaching 60,000 people. And I think in Harold Isaacs, in his classic account of the Chinese Revolution, which is called The Tragedy of the Chinese Revolution, and in every literary sense, this is certainly the truth, as the main protagonists, the Chinese Communist Party, meet a brutal and bloody end at the hands of the Kuomintang in 1927. But bound into this tragedy is the story of the magnificent achievement of the Chinese Communists to build themselves from a tiny little group in 1920, 1921, to a mass party of workers, played a really serious role in the Chinese Revolution of 1925 to 26. And I think for anyone today committed to building a revolutionary organisation, that they offer such an inspiring example of how to bridge that gulf between our small numbers today and our desire and, our goal to be a mass revolutionary party at some point in the future. And I think that, it really starts to illustrate how we bridge that gulf between, our small numbers today and a bigger organisation in the future. And so the whole story of the Chinese Communists, the early years of the Chinese Communists, I think shed some light on how this process is achieved. So I want to now turn to look at the sort of origins of the Chinese Communists, and particularly looking at the situation in China just before and after World War I. Before World War I, China was the plaything of world imperialism. Just about every key imperialist power had their tentacles, their hooks, sunk in deep into China. And, for example, in Shanghai, there were parts of the city that were walled off particularly to the Chinese, and controlled by either the French or British imperialism. And they often carried signs saying things like, no dogs or Chinese. So you get a sense of the sort of, humiliation and intense hatred that would have been for the imperialist powers in China. At the end of the war, China was still largely a peasant country, but the Chinese working class had grown rapidly during the war. And by 1922, there was about 200,000 workers in China. And I think the origins of Chinese communism are to be found in the May 4th movement at the end of the First World War. The movement had erupted, literally erupted around May 4th, because that was the day in 1919 when there were huge student demonstrations took place. And these demonstrations were against the betrayal of the Western powers who'd promised China that they would get out of China. And when they, refused to do this at the Versailles conference, well, this, produced massive anger and resentment. However, the significant thing about the May 4th movement was that in just over a month, they were joined by massive student working class demonstrations, and this was really one of the first times in China that the working class had really flexed their muscles en masse and sort of really, put themselves forth onto the page of Chinese history. And one historian of the Chinese Communist Party describes the impact of these strikes on the sort of radical intellectuals and the student milieus who, had taken part in the first demonstrations around May 4th. And, Deng Zongza, I'm sorry for butchering the Chinese names, a later who was a really key and quite famous labour organiser for the Chinese Communist Party, wrote in his History of the Labour Movement saying that the gentlemen of the upper classes had so far not bothered to take note of labourers. With this, labourers demonstrated their power to bourgeois intellectuals who could not but be impressed with its magnitude and began to make efforts to influence labourers and to secure their support. And Deng should certainly know this because he was one of those who was so impressed and was really impacted and influenced by the workers' demonstrations. And much of the ideological turmoil, and I think you really have to sort of see this moment in Chinese history as one of immense ideological crisis and turmoil, stemmed from the fact that before the war, many Chinese radicals actually looked to the West to solve the China question, in that they thought that the West would be able to, help them solve the sort of whole problem of asserting some kind of independent Chinese nationalism and, establishing a strong and viable, Chinese state. And that and this would be the way to free themselves from all of the humiliation and misery inflicted upon the population by the imposition of imperialism. So when they were betrayed, it caused quite a degree of ideological questioning and turmoil and discussion. And Isaacs, in his really wonderful and so eloquent book about the Chinese Revolution, gives you a sense of how this turmoil flowed through. And he says, "It seemed to touch off waiting impulses of astonishing vigour. Traditional ideas and modes of conduct were crumbling, and the echo of their fall sounded from one end of the country to the other. Young men and women in towns and villages began to break with the old authority of the family and village elders. A fissure opened between the generations that was never again closed. The old ways of doing and thinking still govern much of Chinese life, but they are now being mortally assailed in the colleges and the universities. There was a great churning. The disillusionment with the West after Versailles turned popular attention among the students to the Russian Revolution." And this was particularly enforced when the Russian, when the Soviet government gave up all of their old Tsarist treaties and sort of claims on Chinese society. So this really reinforced, the Russian Revolution has been a beacon of hope and a sort of prospect of actually changing things and getting rid of imperialism in China once and for all. And this was widely acknowledged. And I think one future Chinese Communist Party member described the impact of the Russian Revolution on the Chinese communists as a ray of light, red as blood, that illuminates the whole world. And I think this is a description that really fits not just China, but I think, the impact of the revolution for millions of workers around the world at the time. And it was in this heady atmosphere of questioning and turmoil that the first Marxist discussion circles were set up, and that this was really the future embryo, this is the sort of the embryo of the future Communist Party. I mean, at this time, though, I think it's worth just sort of outlining there had been other ideological influences on some of the student radicals associated with the May 4th movement. There'd already been mutual aid societies and, sort of influenced by anarchists like Kropotkin, things like that, established by the radical students. And there'd also been attempts at forming, communes and sort of collective living and things like that. But all of this sort of paled into insignificance when they were confronted not only with the betrayal of the West, but for the first time with a sort of, a solution to their problems in the form of the Chinese labour movement. And so Marxism really became influential in this context, because it seemed to, in the context of the Russian Revolution and all of the ideas of class and class struggle, it seemed to offer a solution to many of the student radicals. And the emergence of Marxism really, became the dominant current at a time of intense ideological crisis and questioning for the radical students. And Chen Dushu, a radical academic at Shanghai University and future founder of the Chinese Communist Party, had started a journal in 1915 called New Youth. And it was popular amongst students and is seen as reflecting this whole new culture movement amongst the students. And it began to publish articles about Marxism and, discussions about what Marxism represented, and, published a few articles by Lenin and things. Obviously, the students had some difficulty in getting access to translations and things like that, but slowly there was a drip, 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 and Marxism became more and more influential, and students got access to more and more Marxist texts. And with the encouragement of the Comintern agent sent by Russia, Grigory Votinsky, Chen set up a Marxist research society in 1920, and there were 14 individuals who were known to have participated in this group. Not all of them went on to become founders of the Chinese Communist Party, but it gives you a sense of their tiny beginnings. Some intellectuals had been, from the campuses and part of the student rebellion. There were others who'd come from the recently revived Kuomintang, a key nationalist organisation in China, which I'll talk about a bit later. I think one of the things to sort of point out at this point was the overwhelmingly positive influence of Russia at this stage, and the importance of people like Grigory Votinsky and his interpreter played in playing a key role in helping to cohere and to be part of the discussions about clarifying a consistent Marxist position in these early study circles. And so Chen's journal then becomes one that seems to try and proselytise a bit about Marxism, and publishes more and more articles about Marxism to try and help cohere and stimulate the discussions about Marxist ideas. And one of the first sort of important discussions of this was an article published by Li Dachao, who was called My Marxist Views, and this is one of the first sort of articles that tried to really grapple with Marxism and put it in a Chinese context. But I think the influence of anarchism was still quite widely felt at this time. And but after a period of quite rigorous discussion, I think a lot of these radicals managed to clarify a consistent Marxist view. And in the process, many of them, many of the people who participated in the very first Marxist discussion circles left, and not all of them end up forming the Chinese Communist Party. But by November 1920, enough of a sort of clear position had been established that they could put out a sort of call to arms. They issued a manifesto where they said, "We wish to organise a revolutionary proletarian party, a communist party. Such a party exists to lead revolutionary struggles of proletarians against capitalists by taking political power from the hands of the capitalists and putting it in the hands of the workers and peasants, just as the Russian Communist Party did." And like I said, you could still feel the influence of anarchism, and I think the sort of, lack of clarity in some of these discussions, because, for example, you didn't have to be a Marxist to join the youth wing of the early Chinese communists, and it was still much, it was quite amorphous group there. And it wasn't really until 1922 that the second Congress of the Chinese Communist Party that a clear and decisive break with anarchism was made once and for all. But at the very first founding conference of the Chinese Communist Party in 1921, there were 53 members present. So you should keep that number 53 in your mind when we talk about the later period of the Chinese Communist Party and how they were able to grow. But I really wanted to stress here the importance of this whole period of political clarification and the importance of trying to cohere a consistent and a strong Marxist position, because the establishing strong foundations and clear politics was going to be essential for the students to be able to break out of being just a student group and to actually make a connection with the working class and be able to build on solid foundations. So that the Communist Party hammered out solid Marxist politics, a commitment to the working class, a determination to overthrow capitalism, and a tenacity to build a revolutionary organisation. And I can't emphasise enough also the enormity of the task that the students had set themselves. Most of the students at this during this period were what we'd call westernised. They wore Western-style dress. They were influenced by Western culture, and Western ideas. And that, there was actually quite a significant cultural gap between the students and the working class that they were trying to, reach out to. And I think the fact that they established such sound politics was the key thing that helped them overcome, this cultural gap and be able to reach and make and to find a working class audience during this period. That the fact that they argued for class struggle to get rid of capitalism, a clear anti-imperialist line, and didn't pursue politics of class collaboration like many of their competitors, meant that they were able to find a working class audience despite the cultural gap that existed between workers and students at the time. But also I think a key element of the Chinese Communist success from this really earlier period was that they were so determined, that they were really the most serious radicals and most serious committed activists to changing the world during this whole period. And it's really clear that the early Chinese, the students who became the founders of this, and the intellectuals who became the founders of the Chinese Communist Party, made enormous sacrifices in order to see their goal realised. Most of them gave up, quite promising and prosperous careers as diplomats or as, in the civil service or as academics and things like that on the university campuses, and lived a life of extreme poverty. For example, in the early years of the Chinese Communist Party, the party was almost entirely dependent upon funds from the Comintern because none of their members had any money at all, and they also carried out their political work in conditions of extreme repression and danger to themselves. So I think the two key things that really enabled them to go from this tiny little group to a much bigger group later on was their clear politics and commitment to Marxism, and their tenacity and determination to try and build an organisation against quite huge odds. And I think as the future Chinese Trotskyist Wang Fangzi would say in his biography, he says when he went to university, he says, "As far as I know, none of the ones that I knew in the early days at Peking were fortunate enough to survive and to find their way to the top echelons of the party. Many of them died a martyr's death." And I think that gives you some sense of the enormous sacrifice and determination that the early Chinese communists had. Sure. So once they'd actually established a party and hammered out their politics, the first key task they set themselves, and I think, you know, obviously quite an important one, was to try and establish labour unions. And often this was a process of trial and error in terms of trying to find the best way to try and reach out to workers and encourage them to set up unions because, you know, like I said, it's a small working class and its experience of working class struggle was very much in its infancy. So, for example, in Shanghai, the Chinese communists joined the Shanghai Worker Merchant Friendly Society, which had been formed by a group of progressive businessmen in the wake of the May 4th movement. Needless to say, they didn't last very long in this because their actual talk of real class struggle meant they got expelled reasonably quickly. More successful, though, were their attempts to try and form a central bureau of trade unions by putting out a call for any of the existing and fledgling unions to try and come together to form a representative body, that, you know, like a peak body for all this, of the all of the unions. Of course, all of these attempts were dogged by police repression. They also put out an important propaganda journal called Labour World, which carried pieces all about all aspects of the labour movement, including the conduct of strikes, the blacking of goods and boycotts, the principle of a closed shop, collective bargaining, social insurance, and the history of strikes and trade unions in the West. And I think when you, and this is a description from one of the books that I read, I think you get a real sense of how the content of this propaganda was really aiming at an audience of workers whose experience of the class struggle was really in its influence, in its infancy, and quite new to them. There were a few other labour organisations established at this time, but most had some variation of sort of class collaborationist politics or repudiated class struggle in its entirety, i.e. the worker, you know, merchant worker friendly societies. But so the main thrust of the Chinese communist propaganda was a need to form trade unions on a clear class struggle basis. And they hammered this point at every turn or at every chance they got. And in trying to establish some of these labour organisations, they had to overcome many obstacles for a little group. One of them was the influence of sort of mafia-style, organisations like the Green Gang that had a great deal of influence amongst workers, and also overcoming the quite significant regional and language and sectional differences amongst workers. However, there was a key, I think, counterweight to all of these obstacles, which was the arbitrary and brutal nature of work, particularly in the foreign-owned enterprises like in Shanghai, the United Workers and gang bosses alike. And in one such instance in 1921, in the very early part of the Chinese communists' life, a strike had broken out at British American Tobacco, and a communist organiser, Li Qihan, had managed to become a Green Gang disciple in order to facilitate his efforts at union organising. And because the strike was against a foreign-owned company, Qihan was able to convince the foreman and the more skilled, highly skilled workers to go out and strike with the other workers and support them. But one of the experiences that the communists had was they often found that the gang bosses and the foremen were not so obliging when they tried to organise strikes in Chinese-owned enterprises, and that in 1922 the Green Gang boss that had initiated Li Qihan into the Green Gang dobbed him into the cops and he was arrested. So these are some of the sort of things that the Chinese communists had to grapple with. And I think police repression was really something that dogged the Chinese communists throughout their entire existence. But Li Qihan went on to become one of the Communist Party's key labour organisers, and he was arrested again in 1922 for agitating in Shanghai for workers to support the Hong Kong seamen's strike. And this was quite an important watershed in Chinese labour history because it was a strike that involved over 120,000 workers, and it really, you know, sort of inflamed the rest of the country. And while, of course, the Chinese Communist Party was far too small to influence the events, it was a massive opportunity to make propaganda about the need to form unions and to continue their work in terms of reaching out to workers. But the Chinese communists also tried to find other ways to reach out to workers and to, to find an audience amongst workers when they were small. They set up schools and workers' clubs as a way of trying to relate to the more political workers. And students from Shanghai University, for example, set up a school with over 150 cotton mill workers. And these schools had one of the notable features of this school had a large number of women workers, which is quite remarkable given that there was, you know, pretty sexist attitudes towards women even getting an education. And the aims of the school was to really stimulate class consciousness and debate and try and recruit some of the workers to the Chinese communists. And they, you know, they experimented with different ways of teaching, you know, a largely illiterate working class audience. So, for example, one woman teacher, you know, sang songs about women's oppression and, you know, with militant endings and encouraging people to rise up. And they also experimented with things like mnemonic devices to try and teach Chinese characters to a largely illiterate audience. And because these schools were seen as schools and educational facilities, they often suffered a lot less repression and, scrutiny by the police, and that gave the Chinese communists a really useful space to organise and to continue trying to convince workers to become communists. But despite the party's best efforts, during this really early period, the Chinese Communist Party remained a largely middle-class and student group. And while the party tripled in size between the First and Second Party Congress, by 1922 they only had 20 worker members out of 195 members. However, I think that this whole period of trial and error, trying to find a way, the best ways to relate to workers in their small side, really did set down some important, you know, give them some important experience for later on. And I think that the fact that there's a certain continuity between the Li Qihans experimenting with becoming Green Gang disciples and becoming the future, you know, leaders of quite mass unions and really authority figures amongst the working class, you can see the importance of this experience. And I think that the fact that they, you know, that were able to establish an overarching labour organisation before it got, you know, shut down and pretty much crushed by the police, and as well as their sort of, you know, various fledgling successes in setting up some unions and some factories, gave them invaluable experience for the future. Just before I finish this sort of formative period of the Chinese Communists, the other aspect I think where they made some quite serious inroads and were quite successful was in organising the student and youth movement in China. And this was their other key area of work. And the student and youth movement actually buttressed and sort of reinforced some of their labour organising, as I'll reveal. The Chinese Communists had already set up a socialist youth league, as I'd said before, and it achieved enormous success on the campuses by organising an anti-Christian campaign. Christianity had an association in China with all the ravages and imposition of imperialism, and there was immense hostility to it. And so when the Socialist Youth League began organising around it, it really took off like wildfire. And as the authorities were less concerned about organising students as they were about organising labour with their ability to shut down all the factories and the rest of it, that there was, this opened up a particular space for the Chinese communists to operate, you know, relatively unmolested. And so, for example, the Chinese instigated labour organisation of Shanghai seized an opportunity to sort of propagandise against some of the, you know, pro-imperialist and Christian preachers who preached to a working class audience under the sort of cover of the anti-Christian organisations that the Youth League had set up. And they, you know, use particularly one example to expose and refute the pro-imperialist propaganda of Jian Hanwen, a professor of theology who preached in working-class districts of Shanghai. And by 1922, the Socialist Youth League could claim 5,000 members. And while people think this is a bit of an exaggeration, it gives you some sense of their speedy growth and the way in which that they'd really been able to alight an audience around these, you know, anti-imperialist ideas. And the Comintern agent, Lydon, commenting in his report to the Comintern in 1922, you know, commented on the success of the youth movement compared to the miserable efforts, as he called them, in organising labour. And he said that the vigorous leadership of the Chinese, of the anti-Christian movement that the Chinese communists had given, was indisputable proof that these circles can draw into a broad movement significant masses of students and radical intelligentsia in circumstances where the basic direction of the movement touches on issues that are most relevant for contemporary China. Okay, to sort of wrap this all up, we have to now, I think, turn to and look at the experience of the Chinese Revolution, where the Chinese Communists became a mass force. And Well, the main point of this talk is to really look at the experiences of the Chinese communists in China grow and to bridge that goal from being a small propaganda group to, you know, the mass party that they became. It is really necessary now to have a quick look at their relationship with the nationalist Kuomintang. The Kuomintang was comprised of Chinese businessmen, rich landowners, and sections of the bourgeoisie, like small traders and some intellectuals. And from the very early on, the Comintern had argued that the communists should join the Kuomintang as individuals rather than as a coherent organisation, which effectively suggested a subordinate relationship. And this orientation was, I think, quite, you know, was really resisted from very early on by the Chinese communists. They thought it was wrong to subordinate working class interests to a nationalist organisation. And that, you know, Wojtinski, one of the Comintern agent reports, when he made a report to the Comintern delegates to the Comintern, he said that at a Congress of Transport Workers, the delegates gave a cold and dubious reception to the declaration of the responsible representative of the Kuomintang, who called upon workers to form a united front with peasants and intellectuals, but not under the hegemony of the proletariat. And Steve Smith, in his book on the Chinese Communist Party, goes so far as to suggest that they just ignored certain directives of the Comintern, in regards to their relationship with the Kuomintang. However, as the Comintern became more and more Stalinized throughout the 1920s, the pressure from the Comintern from the Comintern to the Communist Party to liquidate into the Kuomintang became more and more intense. One of the Comintern agents went so far as to suggest that the relationship between the Communist Party and the Kuomintang was the Communist Party performing coolie service for the Kuomintang. And this was to be an ongoing bone of contention, and I think also the nub of the sort of tragedy of the Chinese Revolution that Isaacs refers to. So in February 1925, just to cut a long story a bit shorter, in February 1925, strikes broke out in Shanghai, Shanghai's Japanese-owned cotton mills, over the terrible working conditions and the brutal management. And at its peak, 30,000 workers struck. And communist students gave a really important leadership to these strikes. And after the strike, more than 50 strikers joined the Communist Party. So this is an enormous, you know, boost to the Communist Party. And despite the emphasis on nationalism coming from the Comintern and the directives about the orientation to the Kuomintang, Communist Party propaganda really did contain key elements of, you know, aimed at fostering and consolidating class consciousness amongst workers. And so there's this wonderful thing I found in one of the books I read about the kind of messages and the way in which the Chinese communists put their propaganda. And they said, "The union is an organisation that will defend our interests. If it asks us not to go on to work, then we must not go to work. The strike is workers, is the workers' weapon in the struggle against the capitalists. Without weapons, the soldier cannot fight the enemy. And make no mistake, the labour union is neither a jade emperor, come down from heaven, nor a Guanyin dispensing bounties charity. It is an organisation created by the workers themselves." So this was the sort of main thrust of their propaganda, and I think partly explains how they were able to, you know, reach a mass audience of workers. And I think it was particularly the class appeal and the, you know, anti-imperial struggle that was starting to erupt that, you know, helped them win recruits. And so by May 1925, the Shanghai branch of the Communist Party has 220 members. And then on the 30th of May 1925, things really begin to erupt when the police shot and killed 17 students who had snuck into one of the international settlements, you know, were barred to dogs and Chinese, when they'd snuck in to leaflet, and that they'd killed these students, and then a massive movement of workers erupts. There were strikes by over 200,000 workers, and this was the May 30th movement, a key point in the Chinese Revolution, and this is when radical anti-imperialism really acquires a mass base and the Communist Party starts to make real strides forward. But to give you a sense of the struggle that was erupting and the sort of, the significance of it, there's a great description of it in Isaac's book. He says, "The effect was swift and tumultuous. Shanghai, the great foreign stronghold with its western banks and mills and its foreign areas, was paralysed by a general strike. Even servants left foreign homes. The foreigners, accustomed for decades to regarding the Chinese as so many dirty but docile and necessary pack animals, were appalled when this unrecognisable mass rose and shook its fist in their faces." So, So the renamed Communist Youth League sprang to prominence during this movement as well, and grew massively to about 2,500. During this period, the Communist Party established a sizable working class base in places like Shanghai. And by April 26, 1926, it had 2,500 members. Over half were workers. And then there was another upsurge in the struggle, and the Communist Party continued to grow out of it, because the impact of the May 30th movement had spread well beyond Shanghai and spread throughout the entire country, and led to strikes, particularly in the Guangzhou and Canton area around Hong Kong, and it saw hundreds of thousands of workers abandon Hong Kong for Guangzhou, and they maintained this boycott of everything to do with imperialism in the area for over 16 months, which is quite astonishing when you think how reliant China had become on the various commodities imported into the area. And it was during this period that the Chinese Communists became a truly working class and mass organisation. Out of the strike and boycott, they went from a combined membership of 700 to by 7,000 around the Guangdong province, had 7,000 by its end. And I think one feature of the Communist Party's growth, and I think you can see this going back to their attempts to try and organise some of the cotton workers in Shanghai, they really became a party that had quite a presence amongst the cotton workers, who were some of the more militant sections of the working class. So, for example, in Shanghai, of the 119 branches of the Communist Party, 87 were working class workplace branches, and 47 of those were in the cotton mills. And so while the Communist Party's growth during this period was an absolute massive and wonderful and magnificent achievement, it was totally squandered during as the events unfolded during the rest of the revolution. And despite increasing anxiety of the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party about the counter-revolutionary nature of the Kuomintang, the Comintern continued to press to remain allied and effectively subordinated to them. And the Communist Party's allies became their most dangerous and lethal enemy. And the tragic nature of the revolution played out in April 1927 when the Kuomintang carried out vicious repression of the Communist Party and the workers' movement, effectively beheading the revolution. And the party was reduced from its height of around 60,000 members to a few tattered, scattered and fragments that had to retreat to the mountains to avoid further repression. And this is where Mao Zedong, in a very brief, became the key leader of the Chinese Communist Party, but he rebuilt the party out of its ashes from this whole experience of the Chinese Revolution as a party, a nationalist party with a largely peasant base, and recast it totally differently. So the whole, Communist Party as a revolutionary working class organisation was ended with the Kuomintang beheading the revolution. And that is, I think, the tragedy of the Chinese Revolution. So, I guess to conclude, for socialists today, the experience of the Chinese Revolution really moves you to tears. And certainly when I read Isaac's book, it was sometimes really heavy going, because you just couldn't keep going knowing what was about to come. And it can move you to tears, but I think that it also can inspire you with the experience of the Chinese Communists, who were able to grow and to bridge that gulf between a tiny organisation in 1921-22 to a mass working class organisation in 1925-26. And that their magnificent achievement of literally building an organisation from scratch, I think, really proves that not only can students and intellectuals, build an organisation capable of reaching out to workers and finding an audience there, that they can actually play a key leading role in working class struggles. And I think that the Chinese Communist Party also built their organisation in a situation of extreme repression and economic backwardness. And I think that the experience of the Chinese Communist Party really illustrates how getting it right early on, setting down clear and firm Marxist principles and politics, being prepared to carry out the detailed work of a propaganda campaign, trying to find an audience amongst workers or amongst youth and students, that primitive accumulation of cadres prepares you for the social upheavals that can lead to massive growth. And I think that we should take inspiration and heart from amidst the tragedy of the Chinese Revolution and try and inculcate the lessons of their failures and their successes, and hope and be so it becomes part of our own preparation for building a bigger revolutionary socialist organisation in the future.